I am Carol Wilson. Today is February 18th in the year 2000. I'm at the home of Richard H. Dillon at 98 Alta Vista Avenue. Mr. Dillon is a longtime Mill Valley resident, and he lives here with his wife, Barbara. Let me start by congratulating you for receiving the 1999 Zilly Award. And I would also like to thank you for having me here to interview you for the Mill Valley Historical Society. Let's start with, where were you born, Dick?
I was born in Sausalito, January 16, 1924, at 524 Johnson Street, which is now 508 Johnson Street, and completely remodeled, so you wouldn't recognize the place.
Was that your home?
Yeah, my mother's home, father and mother's home. Mm-hmm. And I like to say there's no historical plaque on the both of you. Like in England, you know, all those.
Oh, yes.
You've been to London?
Yes, I have.
You know, every building has,
has something. Right.
Yeah, Jefferson lived here.
Yeah. How did your parents happen to come to Sausalito?
Well, I don't know. Let's see. My father was in the military. He was a career soldier, and he retired. He was at Fort Baker and Barry, so he lived in and around Sausalito, you see, at the forts. He married my mother, who lived in Sausalito, and then they set up housekeeping there.
Oh, I see.
My mother, I think, my father was born in Wisconsin, Watertown, Wisconsin. Both Midwesterners. My mother was born in Chicago, Illinois. And my father was William, Captain, they called him when he retired from retirement, William Tarleton Dillon. My mother was Alice Mabel Burke, who always went by Mabel. And she had kin in Mill Valley. I can't remember their names at the moment. It was a big company.
Mm-hmm.
And so they married there in Sausalito, I guess, and lived in he was probably a non-commissioned officer, I think, then. Maybe an officer. But anyway, they had little quarters there that were at Baker and gone now. It was a small frame house that I used to see driving out to Baker. It was all gone.
Oh.
He was a career Army officer, and she was just she's very sharp, intelligent gal, but I don't think went to college, but she went to Lowell High when it was quite, Girls High, and then Lowell High in the city,
mm-hmm.
commuting by boat, I think, all the way from Petaluma, I think. I think she lived with her father in Petaluma, and that's how she knew this area, and then worked in the city during the earthquake and fire. She actually had a story about going over there to rescue the stuff in her desk.
Oh, really?
You know, like 80 cents in coin and pen and nonsense.
Was there a ferry from Sausalito to San Francisco?
Oh, sure. Of course. Oh, sure. And, yes, she used to go, as I recall, her father was in, I thought he was in fruits and vegetables, and maybe he was in Petaluma, but my niece says she thinks he was in the pickling business in Petaluma. So maybe she went over there simply to get vegetables with the cucumbers, I guess, or something like that. I take the ferry over and order groceries, whatever you do, and have them shipped back, and then I guess went to school or something, or went to work.
Oh, yeah.
So I used to kind of commute on the ferries, and so she would know Sausalito very well.
Mm-hmm.
But taking the train down and she was in the earthquake and fire in 1906, and as I say, tried to get to her office. She was a typewriter, as they call it, a typist.
Mm-hmm.
She ran a typewriter, secretary, and she couldn't make it through the tumble-down bricks and dead cows. Apparently, a bunch of cattle. They used to drive the cattle in, I guess, from Butchertown. San Francisco, a bunch of them were killed. So she was a real mess if she gave up. Anyway, that was it. My father was in. He was an electrician as a very young man in Wisconsin, and then went into the Spanish-American War, and then the Boer War, illegally. I mean, the American. Irish American fighting with the Boers against the British, and changed his name. So you better get that thing. My real name should be Dervin, D-E-R-V-I-N. What he did was change his name when he was in the Boer forces, and somewhere lost in this mess, I have a document of the change of name signed by a cornet, whatever that is, sort of a second lieutenant, I guess, in the Boer Army. Changing his name. He took his mother's name, so not much difference.
Why did he do that?
I think it was illegal. I think you weren't supposed to. Citizenship, passports and things, you weren't supposed to go over there and fight for somebody else. certainly not the Boers against our friends, the English. Mm-hmm. That's all I can figure. But apparently, my son went to Ireland this summer. He says that he, talking to people there, a lot of them change their names, often for some social reason, business reasons, or whatever, not criminal or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often they said they do, take the other side of the family. So it's not very cheap. My maternal side is Dillon, and paternal side is Durbin. So seemingly switched, because I'm a Dillon. We're all Dillons now. We mm-hmm. should be Durbins now.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he retired from the Army. He was gassed in World War I, and ill much of the time when I was young. I used to visit him at the hospital at the Presidio.
Letterman,
of course, yeah. Yeah, Letterman Hospital when I was little. Some of my good memories were taking the ferry boat over to Letterman and visiting my father and having a fried egg sandwich at the, I don't know if you, are you a long time Marine?
I'm from Mill Valley.
Yeah. Well, at the end of the streetcar line, the Presidio was a little coffee shop. We'd always end up at, and all things I liked, fried egg sandwich. As a kid of 8, 10, whatever.
Well, was your father hospitalized?
Yeah,
for
a lot.
Time?
It gas, you know, mustard gas, you know.
Yeah.
And so he died of it, you know, belatedly of it in 1938. March 14.
Mm-hmm. And you had brothers or sisters?
Yeah, three brothers. Jack, you know, John A. Dillon mm-hmm. in Mill Valley. And Eugene, who was next oldest after me. I'm the baby. He died in Fresno. And then Bill William was the oldest. Yeah, but he's deceased too. He was an FBI agent. And Jack was a banker. And Gene was a teacher. And I'm a librarian and a writer.
And what schools did you attend?
Oh, a little old central school in Salt Lake every time. Glad to say it's still there as the library. You ever go to the Salt Lake Library?
I haven't been there, no.
Oh, go, yeah. It's, they've done a nice job. It's City Hall and library now, and mm-hmm. Historical Society is very
I've been
nice.
Told that.
Especially historical. And they have book sales there, too. Library book sales. Yeah. And so I went there, so I was very familiar with ground playing in that field and classes up above. And then to Tam, commuting, wonderful, commuting on the electric train, Northwest Pacific, you know, to Tam from 1937 to 41.
Mm-hmm.
And then to Cal, 41. In the war, of course, but they deferred me until I got a AA degree. By going double summer semesters, I was able to get 2 years done early. And so, let's see, I went there in 41, and I got my AA in 43. In February, I guess, and then immediately was drafted after the firm.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any teachers, special teachers
at
high school?
Oh, yeah, that's great. There are two teachers at TAM, and I mentioned them. You weren't at the Millie Awards?
I was not.
No, well, I mentioned them there, and I thought it was very nice, and I don't know who would remember them except Ivy Washerman, because one of them was her father. Did you know Louis Washerman?
No.
Do you know Abby?
No, I don't.
She's active in the Millie Affair, and she's the editor and publications person at Oakland Museum, lives in town.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother was a famous jazz critic for the Chronicle.
Oh, yes, I was
familiar with John? John.
John.
Yeah. Anyway, Louis was a great teacher. He was at TAM, a speech, or what do we call it, public speaking, we called it then, not speech. And it was much more than that. He taught us vocabulary and also how to quiet your fears about standing up and orating to people.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. And very high standards. It was like a college course. I was very impressed. And then even more so is wonderful man, John R. George.
Oh, yes.
You heard of John?
Johnny George.
Oh, yeah, John R., we called him.
Oh,
he
really?
Was our journalism teacher and the advisor on the school paper. I wrote an awful Herb Cain-like column called Rumor Has It.
Rumor.
It was supposed to be a Turk or an Arab. Rumor Has It. You know, Rumor Has It.
Well, the TAM News was wonderful, wasn't it?
What's that?
The TAM News.
Yeah, well, of course. We made it wonderful.
And they had the print shop there?
Yeah, I didn't take the print shop. I just wrote it.
Uh-huh. And who was principal? Was Mr. Wood?
I guess Wood was still there. Yes, because they called me Duke. And his name was, nickname was The Duke.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember, I think they were running me for office or some crazy thing that I never got, but they tore down all the signs. They said, vote for the Duke or something like that. And they met me, and he saw them, and they pulled them down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some kids picked it up there because the Dillons are, the Irish Dillons went to France, maybe, you know, they're always fighting, Irish fighting somewhere. So then my dad goes to South Africa to save the Boers and didn't. And then in the 18th century, the Irish went to France to fight the British, pardon me. Somehow they end up with, one of them becomes an heir to the Holy Roman Empire. And that got, I talked to somebody about that and showed the story it up. So they started calling me Duke Dillon. And
oh, really?
My nickname in high school.
Oh.
Long abandoned thing.
What kind of activities did you do in high school?
Well, everything, I guess. It seems impossible that I've always hated math. And I washed out of, I'll get to the World War II later, I know, but I washed out of navigation in the Air Force. So I can't balance my checkbook, and I don't understand computers, and I have a manual typewriter. So I think I was in the math club, which sounds ridiculous, but I think I was. And then I was in the rifle club. You know, it was, we weren't PC. You were allowed to become a mm-hmm. marksman, expert sure. shooting 22s in the basement mm-hmm. of the company. And went out for track, but it was terrible, and also hurt my foot, so I never did that in there. I was in the honor tea in mm-hmm. California State Scholastic Federation, mm-hmm. CSF or something like that. And what's her name? Miss Stump gave me the Spanish medal for 4 years of A's in Spanish.
Now they have at the historical room at the Mill Valley Library. Mm-hmm. They have all the Tam pies.
They have the pies?
They have the pies.
Yeah, I finally found mine in this dusty moving of books. I finally found mine.
Oh, yeah.
41.
It's kind of fun to look through them. Did you have a job as a teenager? Did you work?
No. Yeah. Well, of course, the Depression, there weren't as many jobs. So I just delivered, for 4 years, the shopping news.
Oh,
that preview
sure.
used to be twice a week. I can remember, I tell you, get this down for history's sake. I think I made $1.63 a week, of which I think I put away $1.50, I think.
Oh,
that would leave only 13 cents with it. So maybe I put away only $1 a week for college. And then I remember I treat myself to a Wild West pulp magazine and a milkshake. That was with the rest of the money. I guess it was 63 cents I had. Milkshakes were probably 15 cents in those days, and 30 cents for the magazine. I don't know. That was my big treat.
No movies?
Sure. My mother gave me money for movies. Mm-hmm. My father was rarely around. He was, he died in 38, so I was 14. And before that, he was usually in the hospital.
Oh.
So I was a single single-parent family, sort of, mm-hmm. but nothing like the ones today.
Did you do any hiking?
Always. That was all the time. Over to Jolly Beach, now Cronkite, or Tennessee Cove. That was mm-hmm. our main hike over there, all the time.
Mm-hmm. On Mount Tamalpais?
No, not so much Tam. That was further, and no car, we were broke. And so it involved either hitchhiking, my mother didn't like in those days even, or buying passage on a train. We had no money for that. So mm-hmm. mostly just hiking softly to the ocean. Pack up a bag of lunch.
I was going to ask you, do you recall certain things, like the 1929 fire on Mount Tamalpais?
I would have been 5 years old. I'm pretty sure I do. But you know how it is with a child, you never remember, you're never sure if you remember, or people talk about it, or sometimes they show you a photograph, and like my mm-hmm. own children, the youngest, they'll say, you remember that beach in Hawaii? And, oh yeah, I remember, and he was, of course, three or something. And he doesn't remember, mm-hmm. but we've showed those slides so often with him in the mm-hmm. foreground, and then he remembers it. Mm-hmm. So I think I remember looking out our back window, never went up toward Mill Valley, hardly ever went to Mill Valley.
Oh.
We were separate worlds, except the train that cost money.
Mm-hmm.
I think my mother held me up there and looked out the window to Mount Tam burning, and from what we call our gas kitchen, such an old-fashioned house, my job was to stoke the coal and wood stove, with kindling and coal oil and coal.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime, maybe when I arrived or before, I don't know when, they added on the back room was the gas kitchen. Stove.
Oh, really?
And that faced north, I guess, up toward Marin City and Tam mm-hmm. and Mill Valley. So I seem to recall being held up there and looking at just smoke or something, a vague thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big impression, like I remember the snow in South Lido, which was 1932, 1933, what snowed in, did I say Milltown? I meant Sausalito, yeah.
Yes,
you
did.
Even the river, then Sausalito, the water. Right. But I'm pretty sure I did see, or hear of, and see the fire.
Mm-hmm. How about the Depression years? Do you have memories of you were in
high school? Didn't know there were. We, except we didn't have any money, but as I recall, we had real butter, mm-hmm. and we didn't have steaks or anything. But no, we don't know poverty or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just wasn't any, no car, and no trips, no vacation. When my father was alive, we did have a tiny little summer cabin. It was a little cabin and then tent platforms for the four boys.
Mm-hmm.
Four boys in Inverness Park.
Oh, sure.
It was wonderful then. And it was vandalized during the war, left mm-hmm. untended, vandalized, and I guess my mother sold the property off. It was great. That was our only trip, and that was until my father got so ill he couldn't drive.
Did he have a car then?
Yeah. So I don't think mm-hmm. my mother drove. So I never figured it out. I guess she never learned to drive. He drove, or maybe the oldest boys drove.
Mm-hmm.
And a wonderful trip. That was our vacation. Go as far as Inverness Park. It was so different,
Real country.
Being Yosemite, or somewhere. Deer and everything.
Sure.
Rumors of bear. They're probably kids.
Well, there were bear.
Probably, yeah.
Bear Valley Trail.
Teasing me, though, I don't know, but they told me I'd be careful of the bears. I sleep in a tent,
That was fun.
And I had a dog. Oh, yeah, I must put the dog in. I don't have dogs now, but whenever I see one, Alistair and I walk on the bike path, the railroad track.
Yeah.
And whenever I see a Llewellyn Setter, I always notice they're very rare now. That's what I have. Have you seen them?
I'm not familiar.
Splotchy, white and orangey brown splotches on them. Yeah, mm-hmm. They look like an Irish setter shape,
mm-hmm.
and the coat, though, is white, with these splotches are kind of reddish or orangish around. Very nice dog.
Mm-hmm.
Bob.
Oh.
Get that?
Bob. Yeah. Okay. How about the train and ferry systems? You said you
Oh, it's wonderful. I really enjoy that. Ever since I've been interested in, not just history, but railroad history, and maritime history, and the sea, and ships, and cruising, and never yachting or anything like that, but it was just wonderful. All the experience I had on the train was to commute to 10,
mm-hmm.
5 times, 10 times, up and back a week. And then the ferry boats to the city were wonderful. Go with my mother with a boring day of shopping at the Emporium or something,
right.
Go visit my dad. But then we always had a nice meal, and even in the Depression, to get a good meal. I even remember the restaurants. I'm pretty sure it was called the Paris. Or Parisian, I think it was the Paris Cafe, a French restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 75 cents for a fine meal.
Oh, yeah.
And the other was the Merry-Go-Round restaurant, which I liked because it had an endless track with desserts going by.
You
could take as many as you like, lift the lid, you
remember
know.
Remember
that. So I remember those, they're long gone.
Do you remember any natural disasters like floods or earthquakes or fires?
No, we had earthquakes in the 30s, but they didn't shake us up. And no mm-hmm. fires in Sausalito. I remember I wasn't born in Mill Valley, and I didn't live in Mill Valley till, my wife can tell you. When we moved here, we moved down there from Berkeley, in, I guess the 50s. Does it say something?
You filled this form out, let's see. You've lived at this address since 1967.
67?
67.
50s. 50s.
Six. Oh, no.
Six or five?
Six.
Six, yeah, okay. It was later than I thought, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we lived in Berkeley before that. I had no children, and we lived in Berkeley.
Oh, I see.
And so until then,
it says you've lived here since 1953.
Oh, okay, that's
this
better.
This is the form you filled
53.
Out. 53.
What's the 67?
You've lived at this address.
Oh, the house, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we lived only down there in the corner of the much about this country at all. Oh, I know what I used to do, though. When I was in high school, I guess. Yeah, it wouldn't be high school, not grade school. I used to hitchhike up here, I guess. Again, it must have been the weekend when I didn't have commute books, I guess, for students. And I'd trade, in Bill Valley, I'd trade 2-for-1 magazines, pulp magazines, Westerns or Adventure or Sea Stories, two old ones for one old one that I didn't have. Had a little hole in the wall, and I've been trying to figure out where it was. It was somewhere about where Espasti's Creamery was, and now Ginestra.
That
were you in the old days or here?
There was a pool hall.
That must have been.
And out
and
in
a
front
newspaper stand?
Was a newspaper stand, and they sold candy out in front.
That must have been a place then. And is it right where?
It was right up there
Ginestra?
By La Ginestra, right in there.
Okay.
I'm not really sure.
Because Ginestra is Espasti, and then whatever was next door, I know they added that on.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like room there for a tiny little. It was not so tiny then.
It was
a
right
pool.
On. I remember it was open.
Yeah, that was it.
By the Hub Theater was across the street. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, is that where the barbershop is now? And
yeah.
Knitting or something. That was a theater,
yes.
A second theater, huh?
Well, that was actually the first.
Oh, there was no Sequoia. Huh?
Oh, that was, this is before the Sequoia was built.
Exactly.
The Hub Theater was there, and the first film they showed was a Charlie Chaplin, Charlie Chaplin film.
Oh.
And it was like 5 cents a seat, and I've interviewed other people who have told me about it.
Well, I know it looks like a theater, that building across there, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure it was right there, because I used to turn that corner, go up there and do my business, and then ride the train home again. And one time I collected these magazines, terrible, you know, dumb magazines, that's what I liked, and had a orange crate bookcase full of them or something like that. But after the war, I guess my mother, during the war, my mother tossed them, I guess. I don't have them anymore.
Probably.
I would, no, I wish I did.
Treasures.
For real money.
Let's see now. Now I was going to ask you about World War II. You said you were over at Berkeley.
I was at Berkeley. I remember when Pearl Harbor was announced, I was... I still have the record, a 78 record. I was playing Ray Noble's Just Once for All Time, one of his lesser known, you know, he wrote Goodnight Sweetheart. And remember Ray Noble, the English family?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I met him finally and had lunch with him at the Bohemian Club. It was just wonderful. Anyway, December 7, 1941, studying for exams, I'm pretty sure. I think it was final week or something, seems to me. And very distracted shortly, playing that record for intermissions or studying, cramming. And heard the news. And then all I remember next is the blackouts in Berkeley. Remember they blacked out going down to College or Telegraph or somewhere, Shattuck, and all the streetcars were stopped or something. So they put on light, I guess. So they just stopped and parked and left them.
Mm-hmm.
Black as pitch.
Yeah.
But then, as I say, I was, you're not inducted, you're, you know, sent a notice or whatever it is, and you go over. I went over to San Francisco, I guess, to report. And I never forgot this, so I learned the color of my eyes. A nice, very nice looking Chinese girl was the clerk, or whatever it was. And she said, what color eyes did you have? I don't know. I said, I didn't know. And she said, well, let's call them greenish hazel.
Oh,
so ever since on everything, greenish hazel. And then I guess I got a deferment, however that's done. I forget your draft board, that's what I guess, because I was in college. And I guess it didn't need that many guys at once or something. So they deferred me until I was 19, I guess, a month after I was 19, 1943. And then I went to, I was a terrible soldier.
You went into the Army?
Yeah, Army, yeah. And my highest command was almost the first day. They made me, because I had education, AA degree with honors, honorable mention. So they made me acting corporal. Get time on this?
Yes.
Acting corporal to escort a bunch of guys down to Monterey, Presidio Monterey. You had a band, you know, a loose band you slipped on and off, corporal strike. And then sent to Camp Wallace, Texas. That's near Galveston. And it's the base near the town. Texas City was destroyed in a blast like that one that stirred all the trouble
of
the blacks that were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Very much like that. Ammunition exploded. Wiped out Texas City. I don't know what it did to our old camp, but anyway. And at Wallace, I was in the NAR. Coast Artillery, in those days, this is 43, February 43 in March, anti-aircraft was part of Coast Artillery for some reason. So I was in the Coast Artillery Corps, anti-aircraft branch, or something, 90mm anti-aircraft cannon. And I didn't like them at all. They had baby computers. I don't know what you call it. Well, they were like a tiny infantile computer, I guess. You didn't actually aim the darn thing. You fiddled with the box and did some coordinates or some stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's not my kind of thing, so I volunteered for almost anything. You could try, I remember Transportation Corps sounded great to me because it was based in New Orleans. I always wanted to go to New Orleans. But you had to be a 4F or something, not a 1A or whatever, so that's all. What else was there? Well, the only other thing was Air Force, I guess, Air Corps. It was part of the Army then, Air Corps. So I went, opted for that, and they did accept me in flight training.
Oh.
It was a waste of time because I was terrible. I went through navigation. I wanted to be a bombardier because I thought it would be the simplest. And it is, I think, a little simpler than navigation. There's still a lot of, you know, this and that. Also, they have all kinds of mechanical tests, like you've got to be able to, like, pat your stomach and hum and play golf at the,
chew
you know,
gum.
Like, whatever his name was.
Ford?
What?
Ford?
Yeah, Ford. Yeah, I'm like, Ford, I can't do any of that. I can't rub my stomach and pat my head. And you're supposed to learn how to do that. So somehow, by testing me, I didn't make bombardier, but I made navigator. I don't understand it. Cause you're flying in those days 300 miles an hour, pretty fast in 43, and you're shooting a star that's behind you already. And when you were there, it was some time ago, and I mean, my mind doesn't grasp that kind of thing. I was a total loss, so I washed myself out of navigation. I just ruined the test and then out. And usually you stay in the Air Force as a gunner, aerial gunner. And this was a dumb move by me. I thought, well, that's fine. You get good pay and everything like that. You're all sergeants, I think, gunners. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how few of them came home. Apparently, they kept that quiet during the war. The losses were terrible on those B-17s and 24s, but I didn't know that. So then, after washing out of the Air Force, the Air Corps, they dumped me in the infantry. A little bit of training. I'm probably the only person, I guess, my friends think it's very funny, the only person who just couldn't get the hang of basic training. I went through basic training three times. I'm a five-bit of capital. I got the award. Coast Artillery, anti-aircraft, basic training, everybody, okay. Then I go to the Air Force, they start you all over again, basic training, the Air Corps. Okay, they throw you in the infantry, they do it again.
Yeah.
So three times basic training, you know, the hut, two, three, four, they're kind of utter nonsense. Then I'm sent over we sail from Boston on a liner, and this is kind of interesting too, I'm still trying to, I think I have found out the name of it. On the old, an old liner, were brass plates in German with the name of the ship, America, A-M-E-R-I-K-A. But the name had been changed, of course, and we took it over. It was a World War I, I guess, liner, captured by us or interned or something, and then used as a troop transport again, maybe laid up, you know, in the 20s, 30s or something. Then refitted probably and made it another troop transport, and give a name like the General Hassenpfeffer or something, you know, some silly name. I think it was General Richardson or something like that. I can't remember. All I remember is America. It was all over the ship in hard brass plates. And so we sailed from Boston, cold, snowy Boston. When would this be? Early fall. It was cold in there. Maybe a little snow already, I guess. Probably be September. Late September, maybe even early October.
Of what year would this be?
1944. And we sailed to Liverpool, and I'm looking out to see if I can see Ireland there, and I think I see it, probably not, probably a fog bank, you know. And we land in Liverpool in the middle of the night, get on a train, and I always wanted to visit England, and did later, of course, a number of times, and loved it. But all I remember is whipping through England, seeing beautiful countryside and canals and cows. End up in Southampton, and then we're put aboard a British, very filthy, dirty, I couldn't believe it, the Royal Navy, kind of unkempt destroyer, and sent over to Normandy. This is long after the landing, thank goodness, so I wasn't getting shot at yet. This is probably October, early October.
And the landing was in June?
June 4th.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no Luftwaffe overhead, and no cannon fire, nothing like that. Very interesting, though. We came through a breakwater. Amazed me. of ships sunk there to form a breakwater, including warships. They must have been antique battleships or maybe not that big, cruisers or something. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of transports and things sunk to make a protected basin. Kind of. And then inside that were these two mulberries, have you heard of, the other artificial harbors? Mm-hmm. And of course, ours was gone. The American one was gone in July, I think, by a storm. So the only one left was the British. So I actually came in Normandy on the British beach, either Sword or Gold or whatever their names they had. And as we say, we land on this floating pier, harbor thing, then hike ashore, and we get into trucks. And I think the first town I can remember, the first town I ever saw, I took my wife back to it 40 years later. Saint Laurent sur Mer. Sign, church, was back there, 1984, 40 years later.
And then it's interesting, isn't it?
What's that?
It is interesting. You go to Norway.
This I remember. Well, it was very dramatic, though I wasn't much in combat or anything, but still. Remember, we went to a place I'd heard of, and most of the other guys are pretty dumb. I mean, I'd had at least 2 years of college. Most people in infantry were men. In those days, they weren't blacks, and they weren't Latinos. They were simply, factory workers and farmhands, that kind of, not uneducated guys from New Jersey or Iowa or Illinois. But I knew enough from reading. I was a great reader, of course. I forgot to tell you that all my life, from especially the public library, where I got permission to read the adult stuff when I was a kid, instead of staying in a little kiddie corner. So I remember knowing these towns from, I guess, the road races, even.
Okay, you're telling us about the road races?
Well, I remembered Le Mans and Laval and names like that from reading, probably about the very old road races there. And so we went to those towns, I think, by truck. And somehow I got to a train, I don't know where, and went, as I said, went to Verdun, which is, of course, a great World War I battle site. And my father told me about that, maybe that area where he was gassed in World War I. And you can still see remnants of the war there. Unbelievable to be in World War II and see the artificial mounds and gullies that were trench warfare in World War I. And from Verdun, we must have gone to, I think, Dijon or somewhere like that in Burgundy. And from there to Lunéville, where we were put up in a barracks that my wife and I later visited 40 years later. It turned out to be a royal structure. It was just a barracks for us and had been, I think, French.
Can you tell us?
Yes. Then from Louisville, we went eastward towards Strasbourg, which we never reached, or I never reached, anyway. To a little town, to Fort-au-Péroi, or Le Forêt du Péroi, which was a real mess. That was where I first saw combat, though it was just really over by then. No, it wasn't over. I forgot this. Saw my first dead Germans and all this blasted trees and stuff like that. And then we were actually, my first crazy battle action was we overran a German tank, apparently, that was hiding and probably with the motor trouble. And finally, they got it working and got out of there, and they were probably as scared as we were. But the tank ran, and we hugged the ground mostly, and they fired a round or two at us, I think, because I know. And then some crazy officer running up with a bazooka and shouting, "Where is the ammo? Where is the ammo?" The ammunition guy with the bazooka ammo. And I never found out what happened, but I think probably they called in artillery to get it, to get rid of it. That was the first time with any action, really. And then we did make an advance. I remember the first dead American I ever saw. It was not as nice as I could associate. I mean, could ignore the dead Germans, but when they're your own guys, it's kind of difficult. First one I ever saw was a BAR man. I never forgot. Do you know what the BAR
was?
No, I don't. Browning automatic rifle. That's a very wonderful weapon we had, but kind of soured me on the thing. I guess I wouldn't want to be a VAR man. I don't know if they picked him out or not, but anyway, he was the first dead GI. So. And then I remember these surrendering Germans. Never forgot them. I told you earlier that these things are so sharp in your memory. It's, 50 some odd years ago, just like yesterday. These young kids surrendering to us, and they're just drained of blood. I couldn't believe it, just white with shock from like sewer and stuff. I guess the blood runs to your stomach.
Fear, too?
Huh? Fear. Yeah, fear and shock and whatever. They're just blanched, you know, incredible. And a lot of them were just kids, I think probably 16, 15, and I was 19 or 20, I think. Anyway, then we're near a railroad running to, I think it ran to Strasbourg, I believe. We're on the reverse side of a hill, and the Germans are on the other side, but unfortunately, it's all coming back to me now, not in the original recording that didn't record. We're all lazy Americans, you know, so we took over a German encampment, which is kind of dumb. But already the trenches are dug, and slit trenches, you know, for guys, the foxholes, they're already there. And who wants to spend a couple hours digging, and, you know, you're tired, exhausted already. There's a nice one already. So we took those over. But of course, Germans are very efficient. They've got those things plotted to the inch, probably, on their maps. So we get artillery at night, and we get mortar rounds, and then finally, as I mentioned, I get just tired of being in a damn hole in the ground and wet and everything. So I get up and walk around, stretch my legs, and I get hit with the Germans had 50 millimeter mortars, a little lighter than ours, and I could hear it coming. I hear it go, kind of a flop, 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 flop noise or something like that. And I'm like, uh-oh. Didn't know what it was, but I knew something. It wasn't good. I knew that. And boom. And knocked me down, knocked off my helmet and so forth. And I was wounded in the left and right feet and the left knee, and mostly the left foot. And my foxhole buddy, you know, the companion there, was a guy that hardly knew. Can't remember his name even. I stupidly wanted him to go out and get my helmet. I think I'll need my helmet in there. And he did. And I could have been killed, you know. But you don't think of things like that. And he helped get off my boots, I remember, why. I mean, it makes no sense. I'd lost my helmet, so I wanted my helmet back. And it was hurting so badly, you know, the wounds and the heat. I'd forgotten that shell fragments are very red hot. You know, they're not only gashing you and burning, turning you up, they're all hot. So get the boots off and finally a corpsman, or what do we call them?
Medic?
Medic, yeah. A corpsman, a marine term. Yeah, a medic came up and gave me some morphine and down to throw off. That helped that. And then this, the cook had come up, I think, with big canisters of soup and beans or whatever, in the field rations. And he took me out in his Jeep. Only on the way out, I remember we came under shell fire. Now I'm remembering all this. And we had to abandon the Jeep. And I found it was quite easy to walk or run on broken feet with your, with their shelling you. I didn't think I could do it. It was so painful. But because by then, I guess the morphine was working. And so we ran and hobbled and fell and got out of the road. And then when it quieted down, we went got back to the Jeep and went on. I got to a tent hospital or whatever, the field hospital, I guess that was. And even though I wasn't completely, you know, only shot up way down there, I remember they immobilized me. I guess it was a simple system they had of assume the worst. So they, as I remember, they put me in double casts all the way up, I think, you know, a long plastic.
They have to clean out the wounds?
What's that?
Did they have to clean out your wounds?
Oh, yeah, I think all they did, I think, it initially was put sulfanilamide in them, which now is no longer used. It has side effects, you know. But we hardly had penicillin yet, and they used sulfa on everything over there. So I think they just sprinkled the darn things with sulfa, and then encased me in this, you know, plaster cast or whatever it was, and then went to a real hospital, you know, district or whatever they are, I can't remember the terms of this, and that was probably in Dijon, I think. And there I was operated on and cleaned up nicely, and then put on a hospital train, which is wonderful, green beds on a hospital train, going all the way down to the south of France, to Aix-en-Provence, near the Marseille. And into a old Hotel de Dieu hospital there, ancient stone building. And again, it snowed down there when we were there. That was very interesting because I hadn't seen much snow. And it was a nice situation being in a hospital and well cared for. And a lot of Italian prisoners of war who were very, very nice, very obliging, I suppose, understandably. But I remember I was not very fond of nurses. There were not very many nurses around. They were always off socializing or something. But a lot of the work descended on these Italian prisoners. And they were just so happy to be out of the war. Oh, initially, also, this is kind of interesting. In that first hospital, I remember we were taken care of by a German, a great big antithesis of the blonde German Nazi, just big, dark-faced, 5 o'clock shadow, looked like Max Schmeling, the boxer, kind of a heavy face and dark, and he was badly wounded, limped about all the time, but very helpful to us. Again, I suppose, for good reason, we wanted to, you know, get our sympathy and all that, but still, wonderful to be taken care of by someone like that. And then these Italians in Aix, you know, while we were in Aix, 3 months, recovering, toward the end it was terrible, a depression about having to go back to the front, but in the interim I read a lot of books. I had stacks of these books alongside my bunk, paperbacks, you know, the Army editions, and then regular books too. Oh, I lost, yeah, I had a great collection of Armed Force editions, nice little early paperbacks, you know, the Army did, had a, in my duffel bag or whatever it was I had, and when I was hit I lost everything, and my guns and everything, including my books, whether the Germans got them or not. Because after that, the bulge happened, you know. The bulge was November or December, and we were going to be evacuated. Boy, this, to remind some of you folks who are at home, they were going to evacuate us from the hospital at Aix-en-Provence, which is at Marseille, all the way to Algiers. They thought that the Germans were going to come, not just to Antwerp, and the channel. They thought they might come all the way down to the Mediterranean again. So it was kind of touch and go there till the St. Lo and all that. Anyway, after while we were there, we had some fun. We went once. We were allowed to go to a, or maybe they came in Provençal people came in and played their funny music and they had flutes and kind of old-fashioned ancient folk dancing and stuff. You had tambourines. and then once we went to a touring theater. It was a Catherine Cornell, I think, and that English actor in the movies. I can't remember his name. He was, never got very big, but he was a good actor. Blonde mustache showed. Englishman like David Niven, only not, never got that famous. And they put on a Barracks of Wimpole Street in an old...
Is that USO?
Yeah, sure. Those touring companies. It's the only touring company that ever I ever hit, except for Jack Benny in Czechoslovakia. He was over with Francis Langford. But this was good. It was in a wonderful, ornate, red plush antique theater, you know, in France. And we went to try to, we tried to find it 40 years later, my wife and I gave up and she didn't. She's good at that, and it turned out to be now the Bijou, cinema.
Bijou.
Now it's cinema, and we didn't go inside. I don't know if the, probably not, probably this awful movie house theater scene, but it was old red plush everything, benches, and it was marvelous. Then eventually, of course, we had to go back to the war, not so fun. And we trained, and I think we went first to Holland, to Belgium. And we trained in Holland, in Eastern Holland, in the coal mine country of Limburg, like the cheese, Limburg cheese. And the town we trained in were two towns together, coal mining towns, Rupen, Brunchen, hyphenated, I guess there is, Cordemadera Larkspur. Rupen, Brunchen, wonderful people, just so grateful for our rescue and all that, you know, just marvelous people. And the Germans are taking everything, taking their cattle and their chickens and everything, stolen everything. And so, you know, we fed them, but still they tried to treat us. And remember, the only treat was home-baked bread with sugar, very heavy crystalline sugar on it. That was a treat, really nice. And as I say, we trained on duck ponds there with that duck, D-U-K-W, the amphibious amphibious car or truck or whatever that means. But I was not in good enough shape to cross the Rhine on that thing, so they let me come across when they ran a pontoon bridge across. And I came with the armor artificer on a jeep. And the place where he crossed was, I think, Dinslaken, near Duisburg, which is, I guess, in the...
You're crossing
Rhine,
the Rhine?
Rhine province, mm-hmm. I guess, but near the Ruhr. Because then we advanced through the Ruhr, and we marched right through the Essen, the...
industrial?
Krupp works, the armament. Ruinous from bombardment. Remember that. And we're trying to pitch off some Germans. I guess we did. There wasn't much fighting at that stage. I had been in the, Love Company, 315th Infantry Regiment, 79th Division, when I got hit. And that's the Cross of Lorraine Division, which is very nice because the French associate with that. That's mm-hmm. what the Free French use, too. You know, the two,
yes.
the two-legged cross. And then when I came back, I was in the same division, but no longer in the 7th Army where I'd been, but in the 9th Army further north up there for the Rhine crossing. And this is where I lose track of what happened.
Was that after? That was after the Battle of the Bulge?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The Rhine crossing was, March, maybe? I don't know. I'm very bad on this. I think I came back to the line in February, and we did a little noddled around practicing, as it were, and then probably in March. And the Germans quit in April. I can look in the encyclopedia, but I won't. We did police duty, you know, army occupation, moving around at different, often in old army bases, German army bases, and a little bit of anti-guerrilla activity, but nothing much to it. The Hitler tried to get his hard shell folks to form werewolves, he called them, you know, guerrilla night mm-hmm. attacks, but it didn't pan. They'd had it by then. Germany was in ruins and the Russians were coming, or there already. So I did a lot of guard duty and that kind of thing. And one of the painful duties was, I remember on a route between east and west, in a tent, two of us on each guard duty. And I remember, embarrassing, we both got so sleepy from, it was cold, and I guess we had a fire going, and I guess between the smoke and the heat, and you know, you're not supposed to go to sleep on guard duty, you get shot or something, or, you know, executed. And I guess I came awake enough to recognize some American officer was coming, so we were okay. But that post I just hated. We were supposed to stop, Germans from returning from the east, or anybody from returning from the east, fleeing the Russians. And of course we stopped nobody. And we were supposed to be great pals with Stalin in those days. And I noticed nobody was going east. It was a checkpoint mm-hmm. and on the road. And everybody was fleeing from the east. Nobody was fleeing back into Poland or
really?
Russia, or even the Russians. And that was that kind of duty. Well, it was kind of winked at, I guess you might say, like very much like fraternization. You weren't supposed to talk to any Germans, especially young ladies, you know. But that was ignored too, I guess. What else? A lot of guard duty. We guarded an awful Russians for the 10,000 Russians. I think that may have been later, but I'm all mixed up now. Between VE Day and VJ Day, it's kind of a blur, kind of confusing. But I know we were in Czechoslovakia, VJ Day. And then I was lucky I got to the Bucharest American University and studied two things at first. One was radio acting, which I hated because I didn't realize it was all memorization of the same lines over.
Radio? You couldn't read from a script?
Yeah, well, no, but not memorization, but I mean, I'm sorry, wrong word. It was simply repeating, you know, repetitious, you know, and I thought it was ad hoc or somehow, you know, and that's why I used to think making movies would be great. It's pretty boring as hell, you know. You go through 10 times, you walk open the door and pick up the phone, hello, do it again, 10, I mean, you got to have a mind that is not mine for that. So I got out of that and ended up in Latin American history, two courses, and did very well, and the guy wanted me to come back, and I stupidly said, no, I think I want to go home. And, of course, there wasn't enough brownie points yet. You know, we came home on a point basis. We were there a long time. We got lots of points. So I went back to Army of Occupation in Germany. Not Czechoslovakia this time, but Germany. This is probably when we guarded all the DPs, displaced persons, mostly Russians, slave laborers, really. And we didn't take any of the Holocaust camps, but a lot of these DPs were almost as bad, almost skeletal. They wore rags, striped uniforms. I guess maybe some of them were the Jews. I don't know. But I think maybe the Nazis maybe put all kinds of guys in kind of striped pajamas, ugly looking things. And a lot of poor Italian prisoners were, the towns changed size in the war, and Hitler never forgave them. So they were literally in rags, too. They're one-time allies. And I remember guarding all these Russians, like there were about, I think, 10,000, right? That's a lot of Russians in one camp, and there were two Finns. And the Finns, of course, fought with the Germans against the Russians, because Russia invaded Finland in 39. And so they came to me, I remember, and talked to me in broken English, German, Spanish, French, whatever we could put together. They're kind of interesting, these poor guys, they hid their identity, passed as Russians. They would have been killed, really. But they had been canal barge captains, I guess, on these heavy-duty canal traffic in Europe in those days. It was probably not so much now with trucks and trucks and trains. But and I remember I found that the Russians were breaking into their own warehouse, stealing their own food, and I had to call the sergeant, corporal of the guard, and the sergeant, and then the officer, and finally a German, Russian liaison officer. What do we do with these people? He said, shoot them. But Americans don't do that, so we weren't about to shoot these.
Was there much connection between the Russians and the Americans?
No, they had a few liaison officers. I would not mind that. I was a private, a PFC at the most. Just a boring, unpleasant time, a hangover after the real war. Mm-hmm. And I should have been down. It'd be a rich, lovely place, the beach and then the university. We're in hotels and studying. It was a real good program, excellent program. Then finally home. Let's see, repeating myself, I guess, but New York Harbor was terrific. I'd gone over on that America, the big liner, came back on a C-3, which was awful. I was sick the whole way, I remember. Hanging on in the John up in the bow, hanging on a rail. God, terrible. It's like that O'Brien over here.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little bigger, I think, than that Victory. C-3 is a little larger, but not much. And so it was like this, And came home in February, I guess. And rough. North Line is always rough, I guess, but February it is. And New York Harbor. Beautiful, first time I'd ever seen it. I think I'd never seen New York yet, certainly not from the sea, coming in to see the Statue of Liberty. Just impressive. Unfortunately, it is working.
It is working.
I paid attention to my seniors who said, no, you better throw away all this stuff you've confiscated or salvaged or picked up over there. So I'd already thrown away guns and things like that, but I threw away my prized possession for survival, which was a eiderdown quilt I'd found somewhere, along with a woman's, what do you call them? Just a fur,
A stole type of thing?
Yeah, just wrapped around their neck, I guess. Just a fox, a fox with
a boa.
Legs. Well, the whole thing, legs dangling.
Oh, just a little.
And that's to keep warm, because it was damn the time it was cold over there and in Europe. And so came ashore and I met these hateful Germans running the food line. I remember, never will forget that, being greeted by German prisoners, surly, arrogant, nasty. And then a nice quick trip home to Biel. I think it was an army post, and then Biel Air Force Base, Marysville, for discharge. And then by train to probably Oakland, and I guess ferry boat to San Francisco, streetcar, and probably a Greyhound bus, I guess, to Sausalito. And I still remember people staring at me at the on the streetcar in Market Street with this old-fashioned gun. I had a long percussion rifle I picked up in Germany, Czechoslovakia, that I brought home in my duffel bag. Arrived home at the end of the week, I think it was a Thursday or a Friday. I was going to spend at least a semester on vacation, just loafing, reading and loafing. My mother insisted I go over after the weekend, I think it was like Monday, literally, to Cal and sign register. And so I did, and I was grateful, still very grateful. and went right back in history at junior level. She also urged me to file for compensation for getting shot up, and I did. I thought it was kind of, you know, no big deal. A lot of people are shot in the stomach or the head, you know. But no, it was good because it got me a modest check for compensation. And a GI Bill, of course, was nice. It helped me, not quite enough. Young people think, you know, we had a free ride, but no, I think you couldn't afford, certainly it might take care of your room and board, but it wouldn't take care of all your books and things like that. So it was, you know, it was skimpy, but it sure helped. And I worked there a little bit. What did I do? Oh, I ran the check room at the library. I mean, we're for students, and I ushered at UC Extension course lectures, movies, that kind of thing. So I picked up a little money that way. Lived very modestly, of course, in a boarding house, Durant Hall, across from the Durant Hotel. I think it's the back end of the museum now, you know, the Art Museum, Art Museum. I think that's where we were.
Did you notice a change in Sausalito when you came home?
No, well, I didn't come home to Sausalito, really. I came home to Berkeley.
You know?
So I was briefly at Sausalito on a weekend there, and then went back to Berkeley. And no, it hadn't, I didn't notice any change. I think, as I said earlier, that my mother took in the shipyard workers, and of course, that changed the whole town, the Renship. But I wasn't aware of it particularly.
I did ask you about the, I was going to ask you about the effect the war had on Sausalito, the artillery batteries in the forts.
They were out there, and then they were never used. The Japanese Navy failed to arrive, you know, so.
Thank heaven. And then you attended University of California.
Yeah, I restarted at Cal, and I was in history major, a Mexican history specialization, which I changed eventually and went into Western American U.S. history or Southwest U.S. or whatever you want to call it, this side of the border. But I actually took my master's in Mexican history there, wrote my thesis, or MA thesis, on it was called The Rise of Álvaro Obregón, the president of Mexico. He was a general who became president and then was assassinated, like Villa and several others. Interesting man, and part of it was printed. One of my early publications, in a sense, I guess, was they lifted part of it and translated it into Spanish, and it was published in Mexico. And I wasted a year had to work real hard to get both the general secondary and a JAIS junior college credential. Normally you get just the one, you know, I got both as a precaution. And at the same time, I taught at St. Mary's College High School in Berkeley. We hated it. It was terrible. It was like running playing policeman. It was all discipline. The rejects from the public schools were there already, dumped in the Catholic school. The student body president was Jewish. Nice kid. I don't know why he was there. Probably he was a single parent or no parents or something. I don't know why. And there were already some blacks there that had been drummed out of the public schools and some white thugs too, and so not a good experience. And so cured me on teaching secondary level, and so I went back after that. I had an MA in history, so I went for a second bachelor's degree, BLS, Bachelor of Library Science, which made no sense. It was really an MA, another MA, and graduated in 1950. In June, and I got married in June and went to work in July and stayed at it for 29 years at Sutro Library.
At Sutro Library.
Yeah. I was an assistant or a low man there, a junior librarian, I think they called it, a horrible title for an old man of 26 year old man in the war and got shot up and all that kind of stuff. But they, the boss is a wonderful woman. Helen Bruner, wonderful librarian, and she treated me like an assistant librarian. I was the only other one. A couple of clerks, they're always starved for people and money and space. And when she retired, I guess about 3 years later, I took over and stayed there until 79, retired early at 55.
Mm-hmm. And then you were there for how many years?
29 years.
29 years.
Yeah, 10 years about at the public library building in Nooks and Crannies, and then about 20 years almost at USF. And then since my day, it's been out at San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm.
Always a charity case, though, $1 a year or something like that on somebody else's property.
Mm-hmm. Then I asked you about writing. What are you?
Yeah, that was in that part that's gone. Yeah, it was 1934, San Francisco News, a contest for young readers. I was 10 years old. So I wrote the story of my dog, Bob. It was a story, and I think the other kids probably wrote fiction of some kind, you know, what if or something. I wrote a nonfiction piece, and I've always stayed with nonfiction since. It was about the dog stealing lunches from the workmen. The workmen, like PG&E linemen and telephone linemen, would put their bag lunches down on the ground or somewhere and go climb up there and do their thing. And Bob would go and pick up the lunch and bring it home. Then we'd have to try to figure out who lost his lunch. And it was a nice little story, true. He was a wonderful dog. He was a Llewellyn Setter. It's kind of rare these days. And he wasn't a criminal, I don't think. He just had a habit. He thought, maybe that'd be nice to bring home to his parents. That was the first. And then the next, I guess, was Tam High, 1940 or 41. Rumor has it, a Herb Cain clone column in the Tamalpais News. John R. George was a wonderful teacher and instructor in journalism and the head of the paper. And the other great teacher was Louis Wasserman in public speaking. And then after that, at Cal, when I was still a student at Cal, I had my first real article published, Costs of the Modoc War in California Historical Society Quarterly, probably 1949 or 48 or something like that. And when it was kind of funny, I was called in by my professor, wondered if I was the fellow whose name was on the article, I guess, or something. And it was me. Anyway, and then started up pretty much once I got at the library, I guess I started writing articles and then a book or two, and I don't remember, they're listed there by the date, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-50s, early 50s.
And you did teaching and lecturing?
Yeah, well, yes. Had some wonderful teaching stints. Unfortunately, librarians don't get sabbaticals, and they don't get much leave, so I'd have to take, it was kind of hard, you have to take your vacation time, you know, and big time without pay. But I taught First University of Hawaii, summer of 62, I think, and taught UCLA 64, I taught UC Extension, of course. I taught USF in the evening division when I could do it afterward. In education, they had a library program, library credential or something program, you know, mostly school librarians. So I taught things like history of the book and printing and fine printing. And
You have received many awards, I notice. I have a whole list of them, which I'm going to add to the transcription here. Tell us just a bit about the Millie Award.
Well, the Millie was the latest, and it was, I don't know what it is, because I have had a long career, I guess, in writing and teaching. And I guess outlasted other people or something, so I'm kind of surprised. But my wife got one earlier for her art. Alistair, and then but it doesn't tell you who put me up there.
Or you can, you know, add that later.
This is the guy with those public relations. My mind is really.
Well, fun. I can add that later. Yeah.
Anyway, that you get a kind of a sponsor, you know, and you put you forward, and the committee votes you in, I guess. Ridiculous. Just do the publicity for artists in Texas. Don't let her hear this. How could I forget that?
Well, let's move on to your family life.
Yeah, okay.
Tell us about your wife.
Well, yeah, her name is Barbara Alistair Dillon, but she goes by Alistair since she started doing the artwork, and it's a long time ago. She became a potter first, and then had to give it up because of arthritis and stuff. So that's a fiber. So sometimes you see a hybrid, like over there is a hybrid.
Pottery and fiber, and then over there is all fiber. The other one over there.
Oh, yeah.
Big wood. She's great. And she got a couple of years ago, she got a Millie for her art. She's very active in Artisans, particularly. Also some of these other organizations, but I can't remember which is which.
Like the Mill Valley Art Festival and such?
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. She's kind of given that up now as she gets older and kind of a little rickety with the arthritis. But she was in the Fall Arts Festival for years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how I got it, well, I don't know.
How did you meet your wife?
Oh, we were out there, yeah, out there. We were at iHouse, the zoo, we called it. You know, the zoo,
yes.
The International House?
Sure.
The Cal, a wonderful place. And I was there for many years, three or four years, I can't remember, whatever the limit is, they throw you out finally. And she came down in, briefly, I think, from, she was from Washington, and had attended Washington, UW and Washington State University. And she came down to take graduate work, I guess, or librarianship maybe, or something like that. And we met there at iHouse, and got married in 1950.
Mm. And how many children do you have?
Three boys. Brian, the oldest, and David, the middle, and Ross, the youngest.
Mm-hmm.
Five grandchildren.
And where are they living today?
Well, let's see. Ross is in Novato. We call it Hamilton Field. Poor men's housing from Marin. Tiny little quarters that used to be non-commissioned officers' quarters, I guess, in the air base. And Dave is in, he's in a trailer. You know, young people know money at Marin. He lives in a trailer there at Greenbrae. There's a trailer park there.
Oh, yeah.
There's two, one tacky and one pretty nice. He's the nice one.
Mm-hmm.
And then Brian is he's the PhD, Phi Beta also. Oh, and Alistair, we're all three Phi Betas in the family. That's kind of rare. The Phi Beta Kappa now lists multiple membership, or what is it called? Families that have more than one. Yeah, kind of. And Brian's very smart. He's old Dean's List, Fulbright Scholar, led expeditions, he's an archaeologist.
Oh.
And so he's led expeditions to Central America, Mexico, and so forth. And he's a freelance consultant, or whatever the term is, you know, freelance archaeologist, and gets a lot of work from this environmental impact stuff. You know, when you, before you tear down a building, or lay out a shopping center, you've got to dig up with the Indians and make sure you aren't digging up Indians, so he does that. He's in L.A. with a lovely wife, a Hawaiian Chinese wife.
He lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And we always love Hawaii, you know, we go over there whenever we can, and so we have a Hawaiian in the family. It's kind of nice.
And then your other son, David, you say he's...
Dave is, he's a... What's the polite word? He's a grave digger. What's the polite word for a cemetery attendant? Or something?
Oh, is that what
at one of the Jewish cemeteries on the line.
Oh, really?
All the grave people are not are Gentiles, are non-Jews. They must be a religious thing.
Really?
I don't know. So he's there as a, and the groundskeeper too, of course. But the, those are interments, whatever you call it.
And Ross?
Oh, Ross is manages all or some of the Handicap Factory here, which has changed its name a couple of times. The steam, the column
I know
steam
where that
there
is.
At Greenbrae, in Corbett area.
Oh, yeah. And you have grandchildren?
Yep, five.
Five grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Want to tell us about?
No, they're just grandchildren.
Girl, boys?
Oh, yeah, well, Brian has Shannon, a girl, beautiful, and John, a Cub Scout, and Dave has no children, and Ross has... Joshua, who's in high school now, Naomi, who's in junior high, and John, I guess, is still in grammar school.
Oh, good. Very nice.
John's showing some interest in art. That's kind of interesting. That Alistair now takes him to art classes at that wonderful center, Fell Fourth Street, you know, galleries and exhibit. Have you been there yet? The center or something? Oh, it's great. On Fourth Street, there's two, the main floor. And down below, there's an underground gallery down below. That's a lot of cubicles, like, lining this first floor of art, active artists, their workspace. And then the front place is a gallery. Very nice. And they have classes, I guess, in the basement. Oh, multiple table sculptures.
I've been there for some time now.
City Hall, politics, I mean, all I know is the library. I helped open the new library with Sam Hayakawa, two speakers there. And then I went, I guess I went down to the reopening, the, you know, the new opening.
The remodeling. Wonderful.
Very nice, yeah. So my only contact, I guess, was with Thelma Percy at the library, I guess. And, well, yeah, the neighborhood, we have here our Kite Hill, Ed Audio has a Kite Hill party here.
Oh, yeah.
We meet the neighborhood, this year the change with the cost factor, I guess. All the poor folks move to El Dorado County or Oregon or somewhere, and all the rich folks come in.
The valley has changed in that.
Yeah, in that respect, like a little cottage next door is gone, there's $1 million house there now. Across the street and renovated. Our street's all torn up from all this, and this building is
construction.
This, what do you call it? Enhancing, whatever it is, double the size of the house. I guess it's okay. They're all nice people, so that's good. But, it sure has changed, and too much traffic, as you know, and the streets are falling apart. And,
is there anything else you'd like to tell us about today?
Well, no, so I've enjoyed my life, for sure, and family life.
And a very interesting life.
The writing, well, I guess, with writing, you know, writing life is pretty, inbred, or no, that's not the word, it's not very exciting, really. You don't go out and roar around and sail here or fly there. Very interesting. Very the writing part.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Dillon, for.
You did mention John R. George and Louis Washington, the two teachers at TAM.
I think I got that at the very beginning, if not all.
And the one Professor Cow was Lawrence Kinnear, the history professor.
Yeah, well, I didn't get that.
They're memorable. Well, I didn't mention the sweetness of the report. And another man in Mill Valley is Bill Hogan, who took me on in 1951 in the book review section of the Chronicle.
Oh, yeah.
And Bill is a wonderful friend, and he wrote the introduction to my first major book, The Embarcadero. And an old-time Bill Valley. Phyllis is still alive, I think, somewhere here.
Is his wife named Eileen?
No, Phyllis.
Oh, Phyllis. So there's, I know a Bill Hogan, but not that one.
No, he's dead about 5 years, I guess, now.
Oh,
He was movie critic on the Chronicle, and then book critic in the At 51, I went to work for Joseph Henry Jackson, Joe Jackson on the Chronicle. He was the great Western book reviewer. And he died early in a couple of years, unexpectedly. And Bill took over and he kept me on until recent years.
Mm-hmm. Working for the Chronicle?
Yeah, reviewing. But then after changes of head, I'm sort of old-fashioned, too. I'm not in with the new, I'm out of the loop, I guess is the word.
Okay.
Either dead or retired or something. They don't use me. I review for old Western magazines and historical quarterlies, that kind of thing.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I hope it comes out okay.
Well, I hope so too.
Send me a